The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The problem that people are starting to realize with inflation is we're not going to get to 2%. We're running out of runway. And if we're not going to get to 2% by the middle of the year and we start drifting up at the end of the year, then the Federal Reserve, at least at a minimum, not going to find a reason to pivot. And now, post-CPI, we're starting for the first time to price in. They might go to 5.5 at their June meeting, where a week ago, that was literally 2% chance that they were going to do it. So the market is starting to think that this inflation problem is a bit more sticky or persistent than people thought even a week ago.
When interest rates are low, it ultimately means more capital floods into the equity market. Valuations are justifiably higher when we think about discounting the long-term cash flows of U.S. companies at lower interest rates. It implies a greater value of equity. When interest rates are higher, you have to discount those cash flows at a higher interest rate, and therefore your value of equity is a little bit lower. So I do think that this is going to be really consequential ultimately for what to expect. U.S. stocks also tend to be longer duration stocks, meaning their cash flows are concentrated further into the future, as we do tend to have a higher concentration of tech industries and innovation stocks in the U.S. exchanges relative to some of our international counterparts. The result of that is potential weakness in valuations for the U.S. for the longer term.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, make that another loss for the major indexes this week as the Dow and the S&P finished the week on a negative note. The NASDAQ managed to squeak by with a small gain. Stocks were reacting to higher inflation data with producer prices rising 6% last month. If Wall Street is expecting the Fed to pivot and lower interest rates this year, that now looks highly unlikely as the administration's spending and regulation policies keep inflation elevated. Oil prices fell after the Biden administration releases more oil from the nation's SPR, taking levels down to dangerously low levels that would only handle about 2 weeks in the case of an emergency. This week also saw bond yields rise 4 days in a row, with short-term Treasury bills rising to above 5%. Something I have not seen in nearly two decades, as the yield curve continues to steepen, as odds of an impending recession this year increase. The financial markets are blazing new trails, as we could see an elevated Fed funds rate as we head into a recession later this year. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck, Bloomberg's head equity strategist Gina Martin Adams joins me as we look at market internals, a possible recession, and a rotation in the stock market that could hit big tech growth stocks. Following Gina, Jim Bianco from Bianco Research joins us in an extended interview as we look at another inflationary wave that could hit the economy in the second half of the year, exploding deficits, rising interest rates, and more Fed rate hikes ahead of us. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
If I could sum up this week's action in the equity market in one word, it would be churn. There was a good amount of volatility and churning this week in stocks. Positive economic news has set a spin on investing. While it's helping to alleviate worries over a hard landing for the economy, it's beginning to shift sentiment towards the Fed, pausing later rather than sooner, which has driven long-term rates higher. So the main drivers this week were the economic news on inflation and retail sales figures, in addition to comments by some Fed speakers that led to profit-taking for investors that may have already been looking for reasons to pare back on the gains made in the first month of the year. Starting off with the Consumer Price Index report on Tuesday, prices rose 0.5% compared to December, with the year-over-year basis up 6.4%. While this was the lowest increase since October 2021, it was not as low as expected. Take out energy and food, and the index was up 5.6% year over year. Both headline and core showing levels still too high for the Fed to consider pausing. As such, we saw short and long-term treasury rates climb after the announcement from 4.5% to 4.66% for the two-year treasury yield. And for the 10-year yields, climbed from 3.68% to 3.79% initially at the highs before finishing at 3.76%. Inside the data, shelter increased 7.9% year over year and represented 60% of the total increase in the core number. This was the largest increase since June 1982, when prices for shelter rose 9%. The next economic release to influence the market was the retail sales figure for January, which was up 3% month over month. The report showed that consumers are weathering the inflation well, with increases in sales in all categories led by a 7.2% surge in food services and drinking places. If consumers are feeling any sign of recession, it's not showing up in these two categories. While initially rates climbed again on strong data sending stocks lower, prices rallied despite the rise in rates on hopes the economic recovery will be here and continue to develop. The one caveat is that consumer savings have been dropping considerably due to inflation's pressure and does not leave room if unemployment does begin to loosen. Finally, while investors have been buying most of the trading dips this week, Thursday's producer price index and low unemployment claims report, combined with comments from Cleveland Fed President Mester and St. Louis Fed President James Bullard championing 50 basis point rate hikes, was really what did it to cause stocks to finish in the red. The producer price index showed prices up 0.7% in January, which was hotter than expected, with core up 0.5%, supporting a higher for longer Fed. Initial claims were at 194,000, reflecting a tight labor market and companies' reluctance to let workers go for fear of not finding replacements. Mester had said she advocated for a 50 basis point hike at the February meeting, which didn't move the market too much. But true to form, stocks began to rally on that initial dip following her comments as well as the PPI figures. But for whatever reason, St. Louis Fed President James Bullard's comments really set the tone for stocks to close lower on the day. Bullard, a known hawk, said he wouldn't rule out supporting a 50 basis point hike at the March meeting. Both Mester and Bullard aren't voters right now, but make their views known at these FOMC meetings. Recall that the last meeting's vote was unanimous for the 25 basis point hike. Governor Bowman, a voter on the FOMC, spoke on Friday, said the rate hikes should continue until a lot more progress has been made on inflation. So it's not real clear how much influence the Fed hawks will have on the Fed that's already shown a propensity to make smaller increments with only a 25 basis point hike in February to all of a sudden turn things up a notch back to 50. I don't think so. The CME FedWatch tool on Friday showed that there's an 85% probability of only a quarter point hike still, despite all the jawboning we saw this week for 50. My money's on the Fed funds futures and not on the non-voters. To finish the week on the economic and Fed officials' outlooks, stocks were mixed, with the NASDAQ up 0.6%, the S&P 500 down 0.3%, and the Dow Industrials mainly flat, down 0.1%. The two-year Treasury settled at 4.61%, the 10-year settled at 3.83%, both up on the week, and the dollar rose 0.2%. The consumer discretionary sector was the best performing stock sector, up 1.6%, while energy was the worst, down 6.9%. Up next, Gina Martin Adams, our guest technician for the week, one of my favorites, able to combine both the fundamentals with the technicals. And a big thanks to her for spending time at our office this week.
If you look at the recent Congressional Budget Office outlook, they're anticipating an average of almost $2 trillion budget deficit per year over the next decade. And that assumes no recessions. So even with a pretty rosy outlook, we're going to have very, very large deficits. And that's actually a source of money creation and a source of inflation when it reaches that kind of large and persistent level.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today
at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the producer price index came in much higher than expected, showing inflation is still a bit sticky. What does this mean for interest rates and the markets? Joining us from Bloomberg is Gina Martin Adams. And Gina, let's talk about inflation, and we're hearing more and more governors that they may have to take the Fed funds rate higher than expected. What's your view on that? And what would this mean for the financial markets?
Yeah. So I think, Jim, there are two sides to the inflation story. The positive side is actually, even though inflation's coming in a little stickier than many Fed officials had perhaps hoped for, certainly a little stickier than the markets may have hoped for, we also are continuing to see a deceleration. And in January, for the first time since 2020, we saw producer prices rise at a pace that is below the pace of gain in consumer prices. This, in and of itself, is actually a pretty significant positive in that it indicates some degree of margin stability is likely to emerge for the index. Recall, as consumer prices were accelerating, producer prices were accelerating even faster. This was a really critical trigger for margin compression to emerge in the S&P 500 over 2022. The reverse should provide some degree of support for margins into 2023. Now, as you correctly alluded to, there is another side to the story, and that is the Fed. And that's where things get a little bit more complicated. Even though fundamentally the deceleration in CPI and PPI is very good for markets, very good for the earnings outlook, particularly relative to what we've just been through. It's not great for the Fed. It's not great for the market's anticipated potential Fed easing later this year. Our rate strategist, Ira Jersey at Bloomberg Intelligence, does anticipate the Fed will continue to increase interest rates. He still thinks 25 basis points at the next two meetings, but then they pause and they maintain that level of interest rates through the rest of the year. And I think that rest of the year is the area of risk right now, because the equity market and the bond market alike seem to still believe that the Fed will be able to reverse policy later in 2023, allowing for some degree of reprieve from the endless interest rate increases. And we're not so sure we're going to get there because of that sticky inflation.
Yeah, because we're starting to see bond yields back up. What's your take on interest rates? We've got the 10-year now at close to 3.8%. The 30-year is rising. And we're seeing, Gina, T-bill rates at 5%. I haven't seen that in more than a decade.
Yeah, well, you know, it's great for savers. So it is very good for investors in cash. You're finally getting paid to own, you know, to hold cash. That is good for households that are actually sitting on near record levels of cash, with cash growing about 10% year over year. It does provide some degree of cushion ultimately. So in that sense, it's very good. However, the yield curve remains inverted. That short rate is still going higher faster, even as inflation pressures start to ease. We have an inverted yield curve, and that's clearly not good as a signal for growth. Rates across the yield, across the curve, are still going higher in general. And that obviously is going to be a constraint to growth into late 2023 and probably 2024. So the aftershocks of the interest rate rise, I think, are important to monitor. And I do think will probably suppress growth for a longer period of time. Does it necessarily mean we fall into some kind of contraction? Not necessarily, but it does mean that our upward sort of mobility, or our upward momentum and growth, as well as even stock prices, is probably constrained by these higher levels of interest rates overall.
I know that Bloomberg had a forecast of possible recession at the end of the year. You still hold to that view?
Yeah, our economists actually are in charge of the recession forecast, and they do still believe that we will fall into a minor recession by the end of 2023, though it is very limited, with a limited increase in the unemployment rate. I think the consensus view on the unemployment rate is about 120, 150 basis points of increase in the unemployment rate over the course of this quote-unquote recessionary cycle. And their view is pretty close to that level. So we do have a minor recession emerging. You know, for a bit of perspective, your normal increase in the unemployment rate is well north of 200 basis points in a recession. You do normally have several consecutive quarters of GDP contraction. This one does look quite a bit lighter than recessions past in our economists' view. And I generally support that notion, mostly because we are operating with the tailwind of the deleveraging cycle that took place following the global financial crisis. Because of that deleveraging, the economy is set up with less general leverage that had supported growth. The household sector is in much, much better condition than they were leading into the great financial crisis. And certainly demand recovery has shocked everyone in so far this cycle and may remain relatively robust considering that longer term backdrop.
Yeah, there's two things we've been looking at, Gina. I'd love to get your thoughts on it. Number one, in the last decade, where we saw interest rates go down to the lowest level in about 5,000 years, consumers refinanced their homes. They took out long-term mortgages at very low rates. Corporations refinanced their debt. So you have people that are in a better situation, even regarding the amount of debt they hold. That's number one. And number two, what about all this $7.5 trillion new spending that's pushing its way into the economy? That seems to be a stimulus, or at least will make this recession less severe.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, and when you to add to that debt conversation, it's not even just the aggregate levels of debt that are lower, but it is the debt service that households really have been able to repair materially while interest rates were extremely low. The debt service ratios, which are the amount of our monthly income that goes to servicing the debt that we have outstanding, that debt service ratio is at a 40-year low. So without a doubt, households have been able to refinance into fixed rate, low interest rate debt, which means that the constraints of higher interest rates may be somewhat more limited. They also have held a tremendous amount of cash. I mean, we have to really consider the fact that we've just been through the pandemic experience. And in that pandemic experience, we had a record amount of fiscal spending as a share of GDP. Much of that ultimately landed in household coffers. And that still is pushing its way through the economy. We saw that in the retail sales report earlier this week, where the consumer, frankly, just continues to stun forecasters with the degree of their strength. Retail sales so far in this economic recovery from the pandemic have grown at three times the pace of the prior two recoveries. And even on a price-adjusted basis, volume sales are enormously stronger than the last couple of recession recoveries. So it is becoming very clear that the consumer sort of emerging out of the pandemic is a bit of a different consumer than that which we became accustomed to over the last cycle or even two cycles. And that's the positive side of this. Some of this, and this is one of the reasons why the Fed is so concerned about inflation, because the demand component is still very, very strong, potentially even too strong. And they definitely do not want to have high price expectations embedded in the economy.
You talk about the strength of the consumer. You're seeing this reflected within the S&P. You have consumer discretionary stocks doing well. Well, let's say consumer staples have been declining. So it almost reflects the strength that you're talking about in retail sales.
Yeah, and the consumer stocks in general. Remember, I think the thing we want to keep in mind with consumer stocks is it really is usually margins that drive consumer stocks, in particular consumer discretionary stocks. And over the course of 2022, these two sectors really struggled with margins when prices were going higher, when inventories were getting built up, even though sales pace was relatively steady, the companies really struggled with inventory and price changes. Those two factors are emerging as potential tailwinds into 2023 as they've been able to start to right-size their inventories somewhat. Demand is still quite strong. and prices are shifting in their favor. So we should see some margin stability emerge. And I think that that's part of the tailwind for the consumer space that you're starting to see in the market.
You know, one thing that really surprised me in this cycle, Gina, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. We've seen the highest inflation in what, over four decades. And you would expect gold and silver to respond to this. They rallied a bit, but they've been basically in a downtrend. Why? The base metals, things like copper, lead, zinc, those things are doing well. Gold and silver aren't. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a conundrum. I can't help but wonder how much of it is the dollar, because the dollar did surge so very much in 2022 as the Fed was well out in front of the rest of global central banks in their tightening process. Certainly tightening very fast in the U.S. has benefited the dollar. And gold and silver do tend, especially gold, tends to trade in inverse to the dollar. So I can't help but wonder if some of that is really dollar related. I think that the base metals also have suffered from restricted supply, much like much of the energy complex. The dynamics of the pandemic recovery and the fits and starts of recovery have left supply relatively constrained across much of the commodity space. And so as you have economies reopening and demand accelerating and real economic activity improving, which generally benefits the metals as well as the energy complex, but you have still constrained supply, we've seen those prices hold up quite a bit better.
So let's talk about where we go from here. There was a story that just came out today from Bloomberg. Have corporate profits peaked? Are layoffs next? What's your view on that?
Well, I do think corporate profits peaked, at least in the short run, though I think that that story is a bit delayed. Frankly, corporate profits peaked all the way back at the end of 2021. On an adjusted basis, they have basically just stabilized. But when you exclude the energy sector, corporate profits have fallen for four consecutive quarters, and they're on their way for their fifth. Even on an unadjusted basis, corporate profits are down about 7% from their peak, and analyst expectations are that they would continue to fall from peak to trough close to 12 to 15%. So we've been in a profits adjustment for more than a year now. We certainly are seeing layoffs to some degree. Since November, we count roughly 80,000 layoff announcements. The Challenger job survey does suggest that we're now over 100,000 layoffs in the economy at large. So we are seeing layoffs. They seem to be somewhat concentrated in technology sectors and some consumer sectors that perhaps overhired in the pandemic, and now they're adjusting to sort of post-pandemic economic realities. But we did see some evidence that the layoffs spread a little bit into financials, industrials, and other sectors in the economy with the fourth quarter earnings season that the S&P 500 has just been reporting. So we are seeing layoffs emerge. This is a natural byproduct of the margin sort of struggles of the S&P 500 and most corporate profit streams over the course of 2022. You will naturally see 2023 emerge as a year in which cost cutting becomes a very big theme. We definitely are seeing that. You know, we all read about Meta's year of efficiency. We've all read about Amazon's layoffs, layoffs throughout really the tech space and communications sectors. So we're definitely starting to see this transition in profits emerge in the real economy. And it is part of the reason why our economists think that we will have a moderate recession in growth ultimately emerge in the latter half of this year.
You know, there's still, despite that, a labor shortage. I often comment about this story. We have an Amazon Fresh store down the street, and it's remained closed. They haven't found enough workers to open up the store. We've got a restaurant that doesn't have enough workers for, they're doing breakfast and lunch and not dinner. And the Wall Street Journal did a story about employers reluctant to let employees go because if the economy starts up again, they may not be able to replace those workers.
Yeah. I think part of the longer term, more secular theme. I think we need to consider the fact that we're at a cyclical inflection point in the earnings cycle, but within a longer term secular transition for labor, where labor shortages, I think, because of demographic constraints, will ultimately become more and more severe. You know, the baby boomers, as they retire, leave a very big gulf in the labor force that Gen X, unfortunately, is just not big enough to satisfy. Then you've got the generation behind Gen X seeking out sort of very new, very alternative layers of employment, right? You've got, you know, many of this generation, not many, but quite a few of this generation ultimately capitalizing on a social media boom, becoming influencers and the like. So I think that we're at this sort of turning point in the economy that's going to make labor a tricky issue for companies to manage. You know, that said, it is pretty clear that certain industries overhired, and that's what we're experiencing in terms of layoff announcements now. Those industries that overhired workers, most of them very knowledge-based industries that had, you know, engineering talent at tech firms and what have you, those types of jobs will not be as prevalent or available as perhaps they were in the 2020 to 2022 period. But it doesn't mean that there aren't labor shortages in other industries where we're still struggling to find, you know, talent or labor that can fulfill job openings. The other thing I'd say is this, this notion of labor hoarding. I'd be careful to draw too many conclusions from that because it's very symptomatic of late cycle sort of behavior by companies. We want to watch it pretty carefully, but I do recall this labor hoarding sort of language coming up in 2007. It came up also in 2000, 2001, when I was operating as an economist. Companies do tend to have concern about being able to get labor at the point in time when the unemployment rate is reaching its trough level. So they do tend to hold on to labor or hoard that labor. They ultimately, though, will be driven by the profit motive. And if they see a deceleration in revenue growth, they see a deceleration in activity, they will have to unlock some of that labor. So we'll see how it plays out over the course of this year. But I do want to kind of distinguish between what is really sticky, secular concerns on in the labor market and what is simply, you know, cyclical dynamics.
So let's talk about, we agree that the Fed is more likely to continue to raise interest rates. I'm looking at a six-month T-bill that's just shy of 5%. What does this mean for the market going forward? Because you now have cash yields on safe treasuries giving fierce competition to the market.
Yeah, I think this is an excellent point. And it's probably something the equity market is going to have to contend with, not only this year, but for much of this cycle. For the first time in more than 40 years of economic recessions in the United States, the Fed funds rate is likely to end this recession at a higher level than where it was prior to the recession. And every other recession experience we've had, the Fed funds rate has ended at a lower level than where it was prior to the recession. So I do think that it's going to be an interesting experiment and most likely will result in, you know, the relative value of equities being somewhat diminished. Our fair value model, our three-year fair value model for the S&P 500, for instance, implies a roughly 6% annualized return to stocks as the baseline expectation, given this dynamic of higher interest rates, which decreased the relative appeal of equities in comparison to the last cycle. In contrast, throughout the last cycle, our fair value model was very persistently pointing to roughly double-digit gains every year. And we did ultimately end up with an average 11% annualized gain in the S&P 500 in the post-rate financial crisis experience. Much of that was due to the fact that interest rates were extremely low. And when interest rates are low, it ultimately means more capital floods into the equity market. Valuations are justifiably higher when we think about discounting the rate of the cash, the long-term cash flows of US companies at lower interest rates. It implies a greater value of equity. When interest rates are higher, you have to discount those cash flows at a higher interest rate, and therefore your value of equity is a little bit lower. So I do think that this is going to be really consequential ultimately for what to expect, what rate of return to expect on the portfolio. I also would suggest that it's very meaningful for driving sector and even style strategy within the index. It's very meaningful for driving your global allocations as well. If U.S. interest rates are suddenly higher than much of the rest of the world, it probably has some meaning for the relative value of U.S. assets. U.S. stocks are also tend to be longer duration stocks, meaning their cash flows are concentrated further into the future, as we do tend to have a higher concentration of tech industries and innovation stocks in the U.S. exchanges relative to some of our international counterparts. The result of that is potential weakness in valuations for the U.S. for the longer term. If interest rates stay higher, you may see more rotation in the U.S. market to value sorts of stocks, lower duration sorts of stocks, and away from those long duration tech growth and innovation plays in the market, which were so beloved in the last cycle and certainly drove a lot of the equity market return.
Well, I know, Gina, you were here to speak at a CFA convention. What is the feeling among analysts and what did you tell them? In other words, right now, what would you be doing as an investor?
Yeah, I think in general, investors are quite nervous. Analysts, portfolio managers, investors across the board, quite nervous, a little bit hesitant with respect to the equity market, given the year-to-date gains have been so robust and somewhat concentrated in unprofitable and junk stocks. Definitely a lot of nervousness on the part of the investor base. There's a lot of nervousness with respect to this coming recession and certainly very little acknowledgement that we may have actually already priced this coming recession in the equity market. What we talked about a lot is this notion of a cyclical inflection point within this secular regime change, where we referenced that with respect to the labor market in our conversation. I think that, you know, that is pretty dominant, a pretty dominant theme across portfolios. And when you're thinking about that cyclical inflection point, it does look like the earnings stream is going to go through a process of potentially bottoming in 2023. If that's the case, then we want to think about what the longer term growth prospects look like for the U.S. economy. What does 2024 look like in terms of growth? Where will inflation settle? Our sort of set of investments that we think performs decently in that kind of environment are cyclicals in the U.S. sector strategy. So our sector model is starting to migrate toward financials and industrials and away from more defensive strategies, for example. Within capitalization, we see opportunities emerging for small caps relative to large, given small caps' persistent leadership coming out of major recessionary lows, as well as very strong valuation discount. And then we also continue to see opportunities for value and low duration stocks on style and non-domestic stocks when we're looking at global allocations. So I think you just want to keep this sort of point in the cycle with respect to earnings in mind, but also keep a very fine eye to the longer term inflationary and secular shifts that are underway.
All right. Well, listen, Gina, as we close, I know I love reading your stuff on my Bloomberg terminal. Is there any other way that our listeners can follow the work that you do?
Absolutely. Very kind of you to open that opportunity up for me. Myself, as well as my quant strategist, Chris Kane, and our small cap strategist, Michael Casper, are very active on Twitter. So please find me at Gina Martin Adams on Twitter or our quant strategist, Chris Kane, at Python Trader, and Mike Casper is Michael Casper. We post as much as we can. We also are all constantly on LinkedIn posting as much as we can. And we certainly welcome your comments and feedback and follows.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Sounds great. Thanks, Jim.
The underlying technology to ChatGPT is what's called a large language model, an LLM. And the large language model is not simply a data set, but it is a model that has a pre-trained set of connections between words. So all GPT does is takes an input and then it understands all the connections between those words. And then it delivers as the output the prediction of the next words, the next sentences, the next paragraphs. So the large language models are the real revolution. And so listeners understand some distinctions here. ChatGPT is what we call a generative pre-trained transformer. So it is a generative model. And what it is doing, it is, you know, as you said, it's kind of taking all this text. It's been trained for certain connections. It's been trained to not make certain connections. It's been trained to refuse to make certain connections, right? So there is some human involvement here,
right?
But it's generating it. It's fiction. We are not supposed to use ChatGPT to extract facts. So GPT is not a tool that is there to give us the truth. GPT is a generative model. And what's going to happen, right? I'm the futurist here. I'm always thinking about what's coming next, is these types of GPT models, of which there are many, these GPT generative models will work not in isolation, but they will work alongside other models. So it's we're at the beginning of this AI kind of era. And I think the most important thing for people to realize is that these tools will not exist on their own. We are going to start to have two-way and collective level flows of information and intelligence across all of these different systems. So when you start to look at a future that's multimodal, it's a very powerful and disruptive vision of the future.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, on the day we're doing this interview, we just got the new CPI report for January. It did decrease, but not as much as the market was anticipating. Let's find out what's going on the inflation front. Joining us from Bianco Research is Jim Bianco. Jim, the number came in at 6.4%. It's down from 6.5% in December. The market was expecting 6.2%. It seems, or it appears, that this inflation thing is appearing to be a little bit more sticky than people anticipate.
Yeah, I think that that's really the interpretation that the market had. And you could say the same thing about the core inflation rate as well. The problem that people are starting to realize with inflation is twofold. One, we're not going to get to 2%. We're running out of runway. And if we're not going to get to 2% by the middle of the year and we start drifting up at the end of the year, then the Federal Reserve, at least at a minimum, not going to find a reason to pivot. And now, post-CPI, we're starting for the first time to price in, they might go to 5.5. That has now got a 52% chance, so slightly better than 50% chance that they are going to do that, raise to 5.5 in June at their June meeting, where a week ago, that was literally 2% chance that they were going to do it. So the market is starting to think that this inflation problem is a bit more sticky or persistent than people thought even a week ago.
You know, the one thing I think the market is not anticipating, we've been trending down since we hit that 9% rate. What if we get to the middle of the year, as you say, inflation starts to creep up again? And I'm looking at the energy sector as one contributor. But I don't think the market is pricing that in quite yet. Do you think so?
No, I think if anything, the day we're talking, which is the day of the CPI report, it's just beginning to start to think about that. And it's starting to just get priced in literally today that we're going to have sticky inflation. What's also interesting today, this morning, Bank of America put out their big fund manager survey where they surveyed 300 fund managers. And only 25% of them thought that the Fed would go beyond 5 to 5.25. That was today they put out that survey. And now today, the market is putting better than a 50% chance they're going to go to at least 5.5 in June. So the market thinking or psyche narrative, whatever word you want to use, is behind the curve a little bit. And there's going to have to be some kind of a catch-up unless the data starts to turn soft in both inflation and real growth, especially the labor data, like starting tomorrow or this week with the claims report. But we're almost out of time at this point that we're going to have to start to see some weak data. Otherwise, the persistent inflation story is going to start to take hold.
And speaking of labor, let's talk about that. I think last time you were on the show, I talked about we have Amazon Fresh store down the street. They haven't opened in a year and a half. They can't get enough workers to open up the store. We had a restaurant open up here in Rancho Bernardo. They're doing breakfast and lunch. They don't have enough workers to do supper. So what about the labor market? That could be stronger than maybe the Fed anticipates.
Yeah, I like to joke that the problem with the labor market is there is no problem with the labor market. And that is the issue. Three statistics. We know 517,000 jobs in January, and we know that most economists are saying, I don't believe it. Okay, that might be true. That might have been an overstated number, but it wasn't overstated by 500,000 jobs. It might have been overstated by 200 or 300, meaning that you were still left with a very decent number of jobs that were created. Initial claims for first-time unemployment insurance is still under 200,000, even after it ticked up for the first time in 6 weeks. That is a level that is considered boom level, not anything that would be considered a slowdown or a recession. The JOLTS report, the Job Openings Labor Turnover Report, shows that there's 11 million open jobs in the United States, 1.9 open jobs for every unemployed person. You sum this all up. And as I said, the problem with the labor market is there is no problem. And if there is no problem with the labor market, Jay Powell has no reason to cut rates.
And so if we go to that, I want to hit another issue, and that is some people are saying hard landing, some are saying soft, some are saying no landing. If the Fed keeps raising interest rates, at some point, you've got to see further weakness in the economy.
Yeah, at some point, and that is really the issue at hand, is where is that point? The no landing, you know, we're using this airplane metaphor, the hard landing is a recession, you crash. And the soft landing is you just land the plane and it's all okay. And the no landing is the plane just keeps going at 30,000 feet. It doesn't slow down or dip in altitude at all, meaning that there's no slowdown in the economy. Idea of a hard landing or soft landing was about interest rates going up so much. Surely this has to slow the economy. That's why we have all these predictions of a recession. But maybe what we're learning is 4.5 on the funds rate on its way to 5. At least over the next month or two, might only be neutral. We might not, use the Fed's term, gotten to sufficiently restrictive. And if we haven't gotten to sufficiently restrictive, then we should almost expect no landing. And so this is where I think people in Wall Street are going to have to put pen to paper and go, okay, what is a high rate? What is a rate that injures the economy? And don't get me wrong, the current set of rates is injuring interest-sensitive parts of the economy. Like housing. We all know that mortgage rates are up, housing market is suffering because of high rates, but that's not enough. And Jay Powell's been asked about the housing market suffering because of high rates, and he just waved it off by saying, look, you had huge house gains in 2020 and 2021, so you got a little bit of a retrenchment now. It's no big deal. That's kind of his attitude about it. So yeah, if we don't have any kind of a landing here, and we have no landing, and the economy keeps going, the thing that we'll have to start to think about is maybe 4.5 to 5% on the funds rate is only neutral. It is not hurting anything. And if the Fed concludes that, as the market is starting to price in, maybe they have to keep going.
In your opinion, if that happens, are we likely to see them go beyond 5.5? In other words, could we see a 6% Fed funds rate?
Sure. I think that there's nothing to stop them once they go beyond their 5 to 5.25. The market is starting to price in a 6% funds rate. It is coming every day. You could see that in the way that short-term interest rate options trade, that more and more people are buying 6% strikes, expecting that that's coming. So that is on the table if, you know, let me put the ifs in here. If we have no landing, if the economy continues to perform okay without a recession and the recession forecast gets removed, and if the data on inflation, we expect it to come down, it might come all the way down to the low threes. But if it's starting to look like it's not going to get to 2% by the middle of the year and then start drifting higher, and throw in what you said, maybe gasoline prices start inching up, then yes, 6% I could see very much would be on the table.
I want to go to something that we've started up again. Gasoline prices begun to rise again. And I think they're selling are going to issue 26 million barrels of oil from the SPR. I mean, I think we've drawn this thing down by almost a third. At some point, we're going to be at risk if something really develops, like, I don't know, a crisis or, you know, something happens in the Gulf of Mexico with a hurricane. What about the price of oil?
Yeah, so they stopped drawing down the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, or as it was called last year, the Strategic Midterm Reserve, to kind of get the Democrats reelected. They stopped drawing it down at the beginning of the year. So for 5 weeks, there was no drawdown. And now they're going to start to draw it down again. And you're right to take that point you brought up. I thought the reason we had a Strategic Petroleum Reserve was for the eventuality that a hurricane goes through the Gulf, it breaks a lot of infrastructure so they can keep getting oil through the system and creating gasoline while they fix it, or there's some kind of a shock embargo or something, because that's when it was invented, was in the 70s after the Arab oil embargo. And so we are running this thing down to just about 2 weeks worth of oil. And hopefully we don't get into a situation where we need the SPR for its intended purpose, because the amount of inventory in it is not very high. On the oil front, or in the gasoline front, it has been, I think, very effective in getting the price of gasoline down. But now it's gotten to such a low point that it's going to be very hard for it to continue to depress gasoline prices from here. And then people are going to start wondering, when are they going to start to refill it? Assuming that they are going to refill it, they should, hopefully they do. And if they start to refill it, does that mean another source of demand for the SPR that could push prices higher? So cyclically, you could make the case that oil prices are starting to turn and maybe start to turn higher. We could debate about how much higher they are, but at least maybe a floor has been found. And with that, gasoline prices can start to drift higher as well.
I want to talk about something we'll be dealing with here shortly. That's the debt ceiling debate. At the same time, I want to talk about liquidity in the market, the repo market. The Treasury is drawing down its reserves at the Fed. Let's discuss that, because the market thrives on liquidity. What do you do when we're amassing this amount of debt? At the same time, the Fed, which has been a big buyer of bonds, is cutting back on its purchases.
Well, to take the broader question first, liquidity, I'll use a technical term for you. It's terrible in the bond market. It just, today we're recording from the low after the CPI report to, as we're talking right now, the 10-year yield is up nearly 20 basis points. Now, that used to be a whole, wow, look at that kind of day prior to 2020. But it seems like we do this every couple of times a week that we seem to see this kind of gyration in the bond market because of the lack of liquidity. And a big driver of that lack of liquidity is we've lost the biggest buyer in treasuries, which was the Fed with quantitative easing. Now, be clear, they're doing quantitative tightening, but they're not selling anything. What they're doing is the Fed has amassed such a giant portfolio of treasury securities that they have about $100 billion a month that matures, and then they only buy back 40 of that $100 billion that matures. So they run down their balance sheet by $60 billion a month, meaning they don't sell, they just reinvest less. So there's no outright selling, but the lack of a big buyer is definitely a problem in the market. And if we were to get back into a situation where people started worrying about no landing and about persistent inflation, then the speculators and the private sector buyers that have been buying treasuries on this idea that the economy may be weakening, inflation may be narrowing, so I want to own bonds to get a capital appreciation, they'll start leaving too. And then that liquidity problem will be exacerbated even more.
And at what point, Jim, do we get to a situation where we have some kind of credit-related event? I mean, you know, you take a look, it's hard to believe at this time last year, the Fed funds rate was, you know, under, what, a quarter of a point, and here we are looking
at zero.
And we're looking at 4.75 and maybe going to 6. At some point, you have to believe somebody's going to be on the wrong side of this.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about on the credit side, there is that concern that if the Fed keeps going and they eventually get to sufficiently restrictive, maybe they're not there now, that you're going to have a problem in the credit markets. Why haven't you had a problem in the credit markets to date? I think there's two technical reasons why, and they cumulatively matter. The first technical reason is people try to compare the credit markets with the stock market. And they go, boy, the stock market was so bad in 2022. And the credit markets were a lot less bad. They weren't great, but they were a lot less bad. How come the credit markets did relatively better? Well, what got hurt in the stock market was growth stocks, technology stocks, you know, the stocks that ARK likes to buy and the like. But these are not companies that borrow in the credit markets. They usually issue equity. The companies that borrow in the credit markets, energy, industrials, basic materials, consumer cyclicals, telecom companies and stuff. Last year with the rise of inflation was a fairly good environment for those kind of companies. So yes, they were credit and interest rates went up, so they didn't do great, but they did relatively better than everybody else. So that's the first reason why credit has been doing better. The second reason I think that credit has been doing better is the moral hazard from 2020. And what I mean by that is when 2020 happened and the lockdowns happened, what did the Fed do? They announced a bunch of programs where they were going to buy high yield ETFs, buy corporate bonds, and they were going to step in and they were going to single-handedly support the corporate bond market. Or the joke was buy corporate bonds because either the company will pay you back in the form of interest and principal, or the Fed will pay you back. But either way, you're going to get paid back. So there's a bit of a moral hazard. Yeah, buy corporate bonds. What happens if we have a credit event? Jay Powell just dust off all of the programs from 2020 and make sure me, the corporate bondholder, won't be hurt. So there is that mentality out there too. But we haven't really tested it yet with a severe slowdown in the economy. And because while a lot of these companies like energy and basic materials would benefit from higher inflation, they're also highly cyclical companies. And we haven't had that severe downturn to really test whether or not that moral hazard is still there. So yeah, we haven't had a credit event. That doesn't mean we can't have one if things continue to, you know, rates continue to go up, they continue to find sufficiently restrictive, and then eventually we have the slowdown in the economy.
How much do you think the fiscal stimulus, I forget what the number is, it's like $7.5 trillion that the Biden administration has passed in terms of spending. How much of that is keeping this economy afloat right now?
Let's just call it infinity. It's just a simpler way to phrase. I think a lot of it has. There has been a number of studies that have done. Bank of America points out they do a lot of analysis of deposits in bank accounts. You know, so they look at people that earn less than $40,000, $40,000 to $80,000 onward and upward. And a lot of people still have a lot of money in their bank accounts relative to where they were pre-pandemic. And a lot of that, especially at the lower end, is stimulus money. They've been afraid to spend some of it because they've been afraid to spend some of it because they are worried about a downturn. But because they have that money, they are spending. Otherwise, without it, they wouldn't be spending at all. And so you've got the economy being boosted by a lot of what we're seeing in the terms of the stimulus. The stimulus also contributed to the shortage of goods in 21 and into early 22, which gave us the goods inflation, which is a bit rolling over right now. And it might, the stimulus by having the economy rebound, I think, is also changed worker attitudes that we've invented a new term called labor hoarding. Why are we still at a 3.4% unemployment rate, which ties a 70-year low, is because employers are afraid to lay off people because they're afraid that once they've laid them off, like you were talking about with the Amazon Fresh store and the like, they're not going to get them back. So they're just going to tighten their belt and they're going to keep their employees hoping that things turn better. So at the heart of all of this is not only the stimulus that's affected behavior, there is some idea to that. Don't worry, in the next downturn, there'll be even more stimulus coming after that.
I want to move on to the stock market itself. So Wall Street keeps hoping that at some point the Fed's going to pivot, they're going to start slashing rates. And then on top of that, we've got this presidential election cycle that already Nikki Haley is announcing she's running on the Republican side. So you're going to see more activity on the political front. What about the political pressures on the Fed? So let's talk about the stock market, because the stock market is, in my opinion, got a lot of wishful thinking here.
Yeah. First of all, on the political side, I hope you're as excited as I am that we're going to get a whole year's worth of political commercials coming at us. That's really going to be thrilling.
I can't wait.
Exactly. It's the highlight of my four-year cycle. But as far as the stock market goes, the problem that we face with the stock market is the market narrative is the Fed's going to pivot. The Fed's going to cut rates. That is a signal that in liquidity, at least to the stock market, is going to return in the form of cheaper rates. And then maybe they stop QT and they start QEing. And that gets the stock market very excited. Well, what if we have no landing? What if the economy doesn't have a recession and it keeps going along at 30,000 feet? Shouldn't that be good for earnings? And shouldn't that be good for the stock market? Yes, it should be good for earnings. But the problem is the stock market's valuation, it's not overvalued. It's probably average valued to slightly overvalued, but nothing outrageous. But if you're going to hope that, oh, but earnings are going to return because we're going to have no landing and the Fed's going to go to 6, so I'm going to buy an 18 PE stock market in a 6 or 7% inflation world, maybe on its way to 3, that's not a good deal. And so that's where the stock market suffers from the whole idea of, well, if there's no landing, then that means earnings come back. Yeah, but you're already paying a full valuation for the stock market. If we had a PE of 10 and we were talking about no landing, then you'd be wildly bullish on the stock market. But at a PE of 18 on the stock market and talking about no landing, you're paying up for those earnings. So really, ultimately, what I think the stock market wants to get rallying is cheap money. So that's why it's been obsessed with the words like pivot and what the Fed's going to do. And it reacts so violently to every CPI report because they know that that's going to be the critical statistic that is going to drive Fed policy. So, you know, in other words, a good economy is great for workers. It's great for the real economy, but it's not necessarily bad for the stock market, a good economy. It's just that you're paying full valuation for the stock market now, and you should at least expect it to be good. So I don't know how it's going to give you any kind of upward impetus. It might cut off the downside, but you know, you're still talking about kind of a blah market, another technical term for you.
I want to go sticking with the stock market. I want to talk about, you know, we've seen this rally or rotation into tech this year. But Jim, I'm looking at stocks like Amazon, 132 times earnings, Microsoft, 30 times earnings, Netflix, 30, almost 40 times earnings. These stocks are still expensive.
Yeah, given their history, it's like giving them away at 132 times earnings. Yes, these companies are expensive. And this is the problem that high growth technology kind of companies are facing. And this is the shift that we're seeing. Let me explain. Before the pandemic, these companies were traded insane valuations because no one cared about current valuations. They were looking at the Zooms and the Pelotons, the Rokus, anything ARK would buy, and saying, I don't care what they make now. I'm thinking ahead 5 or 10 years down the road and what these companies could be in 5 or 10 years. And that way that got everybody excited. Tesla getting, you know, to being more valuable than every other auto company on the planet combined. But now that we've seen the high interest rates and the turn in these growth companies, investors are starting to say, no Amazon Jeff Bezos or no Elon Musk at Tesla, or we want you to start showing profitability now. And we want you to start showing a path to more profitability in the future. And it's no longer, don't tell me what wonderful things you're going to be doing in 5 or 10 years. Tell me how you're going to make money now. And so that's why these companies have come down a lot. That's why a lot of these tech companies are laying off people. Because when you were in this mode of, oh, what are they going to be in 5 or 10 years? You didn't have to be that selective or that lean in your hiring process. So you had a lot of bloat in your hiring process, and you have a lot of people that you can get rid of. And even to this day, if you combine all of the tech layoffs that we've seen, and you look at all of the people they've hired since 2020, they're only giving back about a third of the increase of their staff since 2020. So they hired way more people from 2020, 2021, and into early 2022, then they're laying off now. But if the demand from investors is to the Teslas and the Googles and, you know, the rest of them, you have to start making money today, not give me some good story about why you're going to be super valuable in 5 years. Then I think you're going to continue to see these companies struggle. And yeah, all of a sudden, 132 times earnings on Amazon is going to matter, where for 2 decades, it didn't matter because it was always about what is Amazon going to be in 10 years. Now it's what is Amazon going to be next quarter.
So as you take a look at the market, we were referring earlier that Wall Street is anticipating a pivot, and maybe that's starting to change right now. At some point when it gets readjusted, I guess the real question is this bear market over? I just don't see that. I think there's going to be an earnings compression a little bit. And I think that the Fed's funds rate, like you, I believe it's going higher and inflation is going to stay stickier. So what does this mean for the stock market?
Yeah, so let's define that. So the low in the S&P was mid-October, and it was around 3,600 on the S&P. And, you know, today we're trading at around 4,100. And the question is, was that the low of the cycle? I'm with you that I don't think it was. I'd probably say 60%. It wasn't 40%. It was. At a minimum, I think we're going to make a serious retest of that low. And I think that we're going to continue to see these issues start to bubble up, right? Inflation is sticky. The Fed's going to keep going. Even though earnings might hold in there because we might not have a recession, you know, 18 PEs, too much to pay for the earnings that you're going to get right now. And the market is going to continue to struggle. And along the way, if rates go to 6%, all of a sudden, you know, 6% in a money market fund and take absolutely no risk becomes enticing too. You know, then it becomes very hard to use that line we use for 20 years, cash is trash. Well, that makes sense when it's zero. But when it's 6%, it's not trash anymore. And so that provides competition for risk assets that are in uncertain environments. I'll take 6% and go to bed as opposed to rolling the dice on the stock market. And after what I saw last year, maybe if I come up snake eyes, I'm going to wind up losing again. So that's where I think this struggle is going to come.
Yeah. And when was last time, Jim, that you saw 5% on treasury bills? You know, it's been well over a decade since we've seen yields that high.
Yeah, it's almost been 20 years. It was 2005. The last time we saw them, 2005, 2006, the last time we saw those yields that high. And so this is going to be quite an adjustment for people to trying to get their head around. And like I said, this is a big deal because I still hear fund managers talking about all the cash in the sideline. People are carrying too much cash, not at 5%. Maybe it's zero 3 years ago. Yes, you can make that case. But that is definitely a fundamental change among the way that people think right now.
Yeah, because I mean, if you can get 5% in a 6-month T-bill, you're getting half of the return, long-term return of the stock market. Not a bad place to hide and stay safe. Jim, given what you see, we've talked about inflation, we've talked about the Fed funds rate going a little higher, and maybe some kind of softening in the economy. As an investor, what would you be doing? Would you be on the sidelines, or do you see anything that looks attractive to you from sectors in the market?
Yeah, so I think this year is going to be kind of a flattish year with a struggle in there. So we go back, we retest 3,600, maybe take it out a little bit. That is going to get everybody all pessimistic if we wind up doing that. But I think by the end of the year, we end kind of zero-y kind of on the market, maybe plus a couple of percent, maybe minus a couple of percent, but somewhere around there. I think bond yields will continue to meander higher because the Fed's probably going to go beyond 5 to 5.25, maybe as high as 6. But I think in terms of bond yields, you'll wind up with a positive return because now you're starting the year. Remember last year, the reason you had such terrible returns in the market was as interest rates went up, prices went down, and you had no coupon. You started the year with a 0 coupon. Well, now you're starting the year with a 4 coupon on your way to 6. So that should cushion some of the price losses in bonds. So they'll end the year with a small positive. So I think the first thing I would say to investors is dial in your expectations. You know, I get it from 2010 to 2020. You know, you could start every year and say, okay, something's going to be up 20 to 30%. What's going to be up 20 to 30%? And how do I figure out what it is and get into it? And that was largely the case. It wasn't always the same thing every year. It might have been foreign stocks. It might have been domestic stocks. It might have been the bond market another year. but something always had a giant rally in it. This year, I don't think, like last year, I don't think you're going to see that. You're just not going to see as bad returns in the market. So dial in your expectations. After that, I still think that the story, if you're looking for themes, is the theme of last year, because I think it's a continuation of last year, inflation. So energy, basic materials, industrials, those kind of companies, they benefit from inflation because they have inventories of real things. And those inventories of real things, oil being the most obvious case in the case of an energy company, continue to expand in price because, you know, of inflation. So I think that those would be kind of the best themes to be looking at. Once you get outside of the U.S., the problem with being outside of the U.S. at this point, given the volatility we've seen in financial markets, is it's all about whether or not you think the dollar is going to go up or the dollar is going to go down. And what you invest in after that almost becomes immaterial. So last year, the dollar was very strong. So if you had your money outside the country, you were in a weak currency and you were losing. This year, there's this perception that the dollar is going to be very weak. I'm not so sure about that. I think the dollar can stay somewhat strong. Why do I think the dollar will stay strong? Because in an uncertain world, the first thing you do is, if you're a foreign investor, not an American investor, but a foreign investor, is you run to the reserve currency, and that's the US dollar. Second of all, if the Fed's going to go to 6% and we're going to have higher interest rates than everybody else, that benefits the US dollar. So I'm not so sure that the US dollar is going to be as weak as everybody thinks. So what I'm arguing here is it's going to be a tough year. It's not like it was. What's going to return 20%? Which sectors are going to be? It's going to be kind of 0 plus or minus 5% either side. I think that the plus 5% is better found in fixed income because you've got the big coupons. The safer value industrial type stocks might give you a small positive return. And the growth stocks, if investors are demanding that the Zooms and the Pelotons and the Googles and the Teslas start producing profits now, they're going to have to continue to retrench, and those companies are going to continue to have problems.
So given this scenario with the dollar, where do you see gold in this situation?
You know, with the caveat that it's the single most frustrating investment that I've seen, because everything you've ever hoped for with gold has come to pass, and it doesn't go anywhere. I still would think that gold would be doing better, but what I'm trying to say is, I would have said that to you 18 months ago and did, and 12 months ago and 6 months ago. And, you know, all of a sudden, I'm starting to look 18 months later and going, I'm not getting a lot of satisfaction out of what's going on with gold. So the fundamentals of gold look like they're good, but they have been good, but it's just not responding to those fundamentals. Now, maybe it's crypto, or maybe it's some other, you know, factors that we haven't considered that might be getting in the gold. One factor that might be problematic with gold is when people ask me, what do you think about gold? And you say up, they say, oh, good, I'll go buy GLD, which is the gold ETF, or I'll go buy gold futures, or I'll go buy options on gold, or I'll go buy the junior miners or something. These are all financial assets. The whole point of gold was supposed to be, it's somewhat disconnected from the financial system, but we've so financialized gold that it's become another currency. So if the dollar is going to continue to stay strong, or at least not weak at a minimum, then gold is a currency. It's not independent of that. It's going to behave like the euro or the yen or the Canadian dollar or the Swiss franc or the Mexican peso. It's going to struggle against the dollar just like everything else. So we've kind of turned it into another fiat currency, because when we say you should buy gold, no, you shouldn't go buy GLD. You should go buy warehouse receipts in a foreign country, or you should buy bags of Krugerrands or other gold coins. And people go, I don't know how to do that. That sounds expensive and difficult. I'll just buy GLD. Well, yeah, now you've turned it into just another fiat currency. And that's why gold doesn't respond to these positive fundamentals that it's had over the 18 months when you think it should have.
That's rather interesting, because central banks have been huge buyers of gold in 2022. And it anticipated they'll continue to buy this year.
Yeah, exactly. And all of that, you know, when you look at the uncertainty in the economy, potential recession, higher inflation, financial assets struggling, central banks buying, you conclude with, okay, I'm going to go punch out a quote on gold and it should be 23 to 2,500, right? No, it's not. It's not anywhere near that right now. Why has it not continued to go up like you would have expected given all of that? And again, I'll come back to, I think we turned it into a financial asset is what we've done. And it's lost some of its appeal as somewhat disconnected from the financial system. That's the appeal crypto has right now. Whether you love crypto or hate crypto, the appeal for it is, I don't trust the financial system. I want to be out of it. Well, crypto is the place. Gold used to have that role too, but we've so financialized it now that I'm just wondering, you know, if gold still has those properties anymore.
One final question. We are entering into our favorite season of the year, the presidential election cycle. Next year, it really begins in earnest. And I just can't imagine an administration not putting pressure on the Fed. We saw that with Trump when he put his tax cuts through and Powell was raising the Fed funds rate. I think they got up to 2.5 and then he quickly flipped. Do you see the Fed pivoting with political pressure or will they stay the course?
I think that they're going to stay the course, but you're right about don't underestimate that they're going to do political pressure. Now, Trump did it in a very ham-handed way. He just mean tweeted that Jay Powell is a terrible, awful person and, you know, and he should be cutting rates immediately. But this administration, look, you got Janet Yellen at the Treasury. You're going to have Lael Brainard the day we're reporting, recording. The story is Lael Brainard's going to leave being vice chairman of the Fed and take the job as the National Economic Council, which coordinates Biden's policy. So you're going to have two Fed heavyweights in the administration who are very tight with Jay Powell. So there will be, you know, that subtle pressure on Powell. But Powell, I think, is an independent guy. And I'm going to take Powell at his word. He thinks job 1, 2, and 3 for him is to rein in inflation. And he thinks it's to get it back to 2%. And that is not to redefine it as 3. And he's going to stay tight and he's going to continue to lower inflation and do whatever it takes. And I think he's going to continue to push back against whatever pressure they get. And as far as the administration trying to prime the pump for the election, they've got a bigger problem on their hands. They've got a Republican House. And so any kind of pump priming that they're going to do is going to run into the Republican House. And that's best summarized by all this talk about a debt ceiling fight. You know, the Republicans want to use the debt ceiling to try and rein in spending. The administration, you know, is playing along with them for now, trying to pretend like they're trying to get to a deal. But I don't think the administration wants to get to a deal. I think they want to have a debt ceiling fight. I think the reason they want the administration, Biden wants to have a debt ceiling fight is he thinks he'll win that. He thinks that it will hurt Republicans. He thinks that will force Republicans to cave. I understand that because every other time we've had a debt ceiling fight, that's usually the way it ends, is with the Republicans caving because the threat of a default. So given all of that, I just don't see how we're ever going to get any kind of pump priming or stimulus between now and the election, unless we have a very bad recession and both parties agree to do it. And I do think Jay Powell is going to stay the course and he is not going to relent on any kind of pressure from the administration to ease up ahead of the election.
So in summary, as we take a look at how this year may play out, bonds may do a little bit better than they did last year because we were starting from almost zero interest rates. Now, as we're speaking on this day, we're talking about 5% T-bill rates, and then could be some rumbling in the stock market, but some of the areas that did well last year, the materials, the energy sector, industrials, maybe that's where you make your money this year.
Yeah, I agree. In other words, what I'm thinking about is 23 for now is just a continuation of 22. Just because the calendar changed from 2022 to 2023 does not mean the trends in the investment markets necessarily have to change because of the calendar. Beginning of 22 was an unusual thing. You know, the high day in the stock market was the first trading day of the year, January 3rd of 2022, when we hit 4,800 on the S&P. It doesn't always work that way, that, you know, the calendar changes and then the trends change. So I'm thinking for now, we just continue the trends that we've seen in 2022 into 23. The big difference now, of course, is that you've got a big coupon on fixed income. So if rates continue up, meaning prices fall, you've got that giant offset that did not exist a year ago. And the things that did well, I think will continue to do well.
All right. Well, listen, Jim, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners how they can follow you?
In my opinion, you do some of the best work on Wall Street.
Well, thank you for that kind compliment. Well, we do provide an institutional level research product called Bianco Research, and you can go to our website at biancoresearch.com. You can request a free trial. That's one way you can look at us up. Otherwise, I do try to stay active on social media, recognizing that not everybody can afford an institutional level product. So you can follow me at Bianco Research. I will preface that, make sure it's the one with nearly 300,000 followers in the blue check mark. There's lots of people that try to impersonate me. So you make sure you get the right one. And then you can follow me on LinkedIn at Jim Bianco as well, too.
Well, great, Jim. Always great speaking with you. And I hope to talk to you again. Have yourself a great rest of the year and come back again.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.